Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. Hope you guys have been doing good. We are going to be jumping in to another excellent piece by Hans Hermann Hoppe. We are going right into another long one, so this will definitely be broken up into a number of episodes. Also, not sure how long this one will end up being. I'd probably guess right now maybe four parts, possibly five. It could take out the whole week. But this is an excellent piece by Hoppe that really gets into the underlying concepts of money as a media of exchange, and more importantly, why markets tend toward one money, like what kind of the elements involved there, understanding how money is subjective, and how all value measurement is subjective, and just a lot of really, really great topics gone through this entire piece. And it is titled, How is Fiat Money Possible? And we will discuss this one quite a bit afterwards. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into this piece by Hans Hermann Hoppe, and we will chat about it afterward. How is fiat money possible? Or The Devolution of Money and Credit by Hans Hermann Hoppe. Fiat money is the term for a medium of exchange which is neither a commercial commodity, a consumer or a producer good, nor title to any such commodity. In other words, irredeemable paper money. In contrast, commodity money refers to a medium of exchange which is either a commercial commodity or a title thereto. There is no doubt that fiat money is possible. Its theoretical possibility was recognized long ago, and since 1971, when the last remnants of a former international gold or commodity standard were abolished, all monies everywhere have in fact been nothing but irredeemable pieces of paper. The question to be addressed in this paper is rather, how is fiat money possible? More specifically, can fiat money arise as the natural outcome of the interactions between self-interested individuals, or is it possible to introduce it without violating either principles of justice or economic efficiency? It will be argued that the answer to the latter question must be negative, and that no fiat money can ever arise, quote, innocently or immaculately. The arguments advancing this thesis will be largely constructive and systematic. However, given the fact that the thesis has frequently been disputed, along the way, various prominent counterarguments will be criticized, specifically the arguments of the monetarists, especially Irving Fisher and Milton Friedman, and of some Austrian free bankers, especially Lawrence White and George Selgin, in ethical and/or economic support of either a total or a fractional fiat money will be refuted. The origin of money. Man participates in an exchange economy instead of remaining in self-sufficient isolation, insofar as he prefers more goods over less, and is capable of recognizing the higher productivity of a system of division of labor. The same narrow intelligence and self-interest is sufficient to explain the emergence of a, and ultimately only one, commodity money, and ultimately only one, worldwide monetary economy. Finding their markets as buyers and sellers of goods restricted to instances of double coincidences of wants. A wants what B has, and B wants what A has. Each person may still expand his own market and thus profit more fully from the advantages of extended division of labor if he is willing to accept not only directly useful goods in exchange, but also goods with a higher degree of marketability than those surrendered. For even if they have no direct use value to an actor, the ownership of relatively more marketable goods implies by definition that such goods may in turn be more easily resold for other directly useful goods in later exchanges, and hence that their owner has come closer to reaching an ultimate goal unattainable through direct exchange. Motivated only by self-interest and based on the observation that directly traded goods possess different degrees of marketability, some individuals begin to demand specific goods, not for their own sake, but for the sake of employing them as a medium of exchange. By adding a new component to the pre-existing or barter demand for these goods, their marketability is still further enhanced. Based on their perception of this fact, other market participants increasingly choose the same goods for their inventory of exchange media, as it is in their own interest to select such commodities as media of exchange that are already employed by others for the same purpose. Initially, a variety of goods may be in demand as common media of exchange. However, since a good is demanded as a medium of exchange rather than for the consumption or production purposes, in order to facilitate future purchases of directly serviceable goods, or in other words, to help one buy more cheaply, and simultaneously widen one's market as a seller of directly useful goods and services, or in other words, help one sell more dearly. The more widely a commodity is used as a medium of exchange, the better it will perform its function. Because each market participant naturally prefers the acquisition of a more marketable and, in the end, universally marketable medium of exchange to that of a less or non-universally marketable one, quote, there would be an inevitable tendency for the less marketable of the series of goods used as media of exchange to be one by one rejected until at last only a single commodity remained, which was universally employed as a medium of exchange. In a word, money. End quote. With this, and historically with the establishment of the international gold standard in the course of the 19th century till 1914, the end desired through any one market participant's demand for medium of exchange is fully accomplished. With the prices of all consumer and capital goods expressed in terms of a single commodity, demand and supply can take effect on a worldwide scale, unrestricted by absences of double coincidence of wants. Because of its universal acceptability, accounting in terms of such money contains the most complete and accurate expression of any producer's opportunity costs. At the same time, with only one universal money in use, rather than several ones of limited acceptability, the market participants' expenditures of directly serviceable goods on holdings of only indirectly useful media of exchange are optimally economized. And with expenditures on indirectly useful goods so economized, real wealth, or in other words, wealth in the form of stocks of producer and consumer goods, is optimized as well. According to a long Spanish, French, Austrian, American tradition of monetary theory, money's originary function, arising out of the existence of uncertainty, is that of a medium of exchange. Money must emerge as a commodity money, because something can be demanded as a medium of exchange only if it has a pre-existing barter demand. Indeed, it must have been a highly marketable barter commodity, and the competition between monies qua media of exchange inevitably leads to a tendency of converging toward a single money as the most easily resold and readily accepted commodity. In light of this, several popular notions of monetary theory are immediately revealed as misguided or fallacious. What about the idea of a commodity reserve currency? Can bundles or baskets of goods or titles thereto be money? No, because bundles of different goods are by definition less easily saleable than the most easily saleable of its various components, and hence commodity baskets are uniquely unsuited to perform the function of a media of exchange, and it thus is no mere accident that no historic examples for such money exist. What about the Friedmanite idea of freely fluctuating, quote, natural monies, or of, quote, optimal currency areas? It must be regarded as absurd, except as an intermediate step in the development of an international money. Strictly speaking, a monetary system with rival monies of freely fluctuating exchange rates is still a system of partial barter, riddled with the problem of requiring double coincidences of wants in order for exchanges to take place. The lasting existence of such a system is dysfunctional of the very purpose of money, of facilitating exchange instead of making it more difficult, and of expanding one's market rather than restricting it. There are no more, quote, optimal local, regional, national, or multinational monies or currency areas than there are, quote, optimal trading areas. Instead, as long as more wealth is preferred to less and under conditions of uncertainty, just as the only, quote, optimal trading area is the whole world market, so the only optimal money is one money, and the only optimal currency area, the entire globe. What about the idea central to monetarist thought since Irving Fisher that money is, quote, a measure of value and of the notion of monetary stabilization? It represents a tangle of confusion and falsehood. First and foremost, while there exists a motive, a purpose for actors wanting to own media of exchange, no motive, purpose, or need can be discovered for wanting to possess a measure of value. Action and exchange are expressive of preferences. Each person values what he acquires more highly than what he surrenders, not of identity or equivalency. No one ever needs to measure value. It is easily explained why actors would want to use cardinal numbers to count and construct measurement in instruments to measure space, weight, mass, and time. In a world of quantitative determinateness, i.e., in a world of scarcity, where things can render strictly limited effects only, counting and measuring are the prerequisite for successful action. But what imaginable technical or economic need could there possibly be for a measure of value? Second, setting these difficulties aside for a moment and assuming that money indeed measures value, such that the money price, paid for a good, represents a cardinal measure of this good's value, in the same way as a ruler measures space, another insurmountable problem results. When the question arises, quote, what is the value of this measure of value? Surely, it must have value just as the ruler must have value, otherwise no one would want to own either one. Yet, it would obviously be absurd to answer that the value of a unit of money, $1, is one. One what? Such a reply would be as nonsensical as answering a question concerning the value of a yardstick by saying, 1 yard. The value of a cardinal measure cannot be expressed in terms of this measure itself. Rather, its value must be expressed in ordinal terms. It is better to have cardinal numbers and measures of length or weight than merely to have ordinal measures at one's disposal. Likewise, it is better if, because of the existence of a medium of exchange, one is able to resort to cardinal numbers in one's cost accounting, rather than having to rely solely on ordinal accounting procedures, as would be the case in a barter economy. But it is impossible to express in cardinal terms how much more value the former techniques are as compared with the latter. Only ordinal judgments are possible. It is precisely in this sense, then, that ordinal numbers, ranking, preferring, must be regarded as more fundamental than cardinal ones, and value be considered an irreducibly subjective, non-quantifiable magnitude. All right, I want to butt in here for just a second, and we'll hit our sponsor right after this, but I just kind of want to clear up this paragraph, or really this section, what he is meaning by the elusiveness or the lack of need for a measure of value, and how the concept of a measure of value doesn't really make any sense anyway. And he's right. It's just... it's really, really nuanced, and the way he words it is a little bit, is really hard to follow, particularly with the constant use of ordinal versus cardinal, if you're not quite getting what he is meaning there. Ordinal means essentially that it's in a hierarchy. You can only express it in terms of other things that are on the exact same hierarchy. Whereas cardinal basically would mean a fundamental measure, as if like sort of that it would be objective. And value is never objective. That's kind of the point of this, is that the only way to label a value, like, or to measure a value, is in relation to something else that has a perceived value, which is subjective. So you've got a subjective measurement that is based off of previous subjective measurements. And because of that, all the action, he says a really great sentence, I tried to emphasize it in the writing, where is it? Action and exchange are expressive of preferences, not identity or equivalency. So what he's saying there is that when someone, you know, builds 1,000 TVs and then sells those TVs for a certain amount of money, of the most saleable good, what they are suggesting is that they are expressing their preference that the money is worth more than the good that they have. And on the marginal utility of a TV, obviously it's not a whole lot more valuable to have 1,000 TVs than one TV. You can't watch 1,000 TVs at once. Because of that, the preference, their preference, personal preference, is that the value of the money in relation to the value of the TVs that simply they have because of their situation, the money is worth more. However, in the opposite, the other person who makes the exchange with them, exchanging their money for the television, is showing a preference in the reverse. So this is not, the TV is worth more than the saleable good that they have acquired. So it's not a show of identity. It's not saying that this price equals the value of this good. It's saying that in that one situation, the preferences line up such that both can make an exchange, acquiring a more valuable good for themselves. And the role of the most saleable good in that situation is of being is being the one whose value is in its network effect, its value is in its salability. Therefore, it ends up becoming money simply because it has the widest range of people who have their own subjective comparison for what it's worth. So hopefully that makes it more clear what he is attempting to get across there. Let's hit our sponsor really fast, and we will jump back in and read a little bit more before we close this episode out. Moreover, if it were indeed the function of money to serve as a measure of value, one must wonder why the demand for such a thing should ever systematically exceed one per person. The demand for rulers, scales, and clocks, for instance, exceeds one per person only because of differences in location or handiness, or the possibility of their breaking or failing. Apart from this, at any given point in time and space, no one would want to hold more than one measurement instrument of homogeneous quality, because a single measurement instrument can render all possible measurement services. A second instrument of its kind would be useless. Third, in any case, whatever the characteristicum specificum of money may be, money is a good. Yet if it is a good, then it falls under the law of marginal utility, and this law contradicts any notion of a stable or constant valued good. The law follows from the proposition that every actor at any given point in time acts in accordance with his subjective preference scale and chooses to do what he expects, rightly or wrongly, to satisfy him more rather than less, and that in doing so, he must invariably employ quantitatively definite or limited units of qualitatively distinct goods as means, and thus, by implication, must be capable of recognizing unit additions and subtractions to and from his supply of means. From this incontestably true proposition, it follows that 1. An actor always prefers a larger supply of a good over a smaller one. In other words, he ranks the marginal utility of a larger sized unit of a good higher than that of a smaller sized unit of the same good. And 2, any increment in the supply of a good by an additional unit of any unit size that an actor considers and distinguishes as relevant will be ranked lower or valued less than any same-sized unit of this good already in one's possession, as it can only be employed as a means for the removal of an uneasiness deemed less urgent than the least urgent one up to now satisfied by the same-sized unit of the good. In other words, the marginal utility of a given-sized unit of a good decreases as the supply of such units increases, or increases as the supply of such units decreases. Each change in the supply of a good, then, leads to a change in this good's marginal utility. Any change in the supply of a good A, as perceived by an actor X, leads to X's reevaluation of A. X attaches a different value rank to A now. Hence, the search for a stable or constant valued good is obviously illusory from the outset, on a par with wanting to square the circle, for every action involves exchange, and every exchange alters the supply of some good. It either results in a diminution of the supply of a good, as in pure consumption, or it leads to a diminution of one and an incrementation of another, as in production or interpersonal exchange. In either case, as supplies changed in the course of any action, so are the values of the goods involved. To act is to purposefully alter the value of goods. Hence, a stable valued good, money or anything else, must be considered a constructive or praxeological impossibility. Finally, as regards to the idea of a money, a dollar, of constant purchasing power, there is first the fundamental problem that the purchasing power of money cannot be measured, and that the construction of price indices, any index, is scientifically arbitrary, in other words, as good or bad as any other. What goods are to be included? What relative weight should be attached to each of them? What about the problem that individual actors value the same things differently and are concerned about different commodity baskets, or that the same individual evaluates the same basket differently at different times? What is one to do with changes in the quality of goods, or with entirely new products? Moreover, what is so great about stable purchasing power anyway, however that term may be arbitrarily defined? To be sure, it is obviously preferable to have a, quote, stable money rather than an inflationary one, yet surely a money whose purchasing power per unit increased, or a deflationary money, would be preferable to a stable one. What about the thesis that in the absence of any legal restrictions on money, non-interest-bearing cash would be completely replaced by interest-bearing securities? Such displacement is conceivable only in equilibrium, where there is no uncertainty, and hence no one could gain any satisfaction from being prepared for future contingencies, as these are, per assumption, ruled out of existence. Under the omnipresent human condition of uncertainty, however, even if all legal restrictions on free entry were removed, a demand for non-interest-bearing cash, as distinct from a demand for equity or debt claims, like stocks, bonds, or mutual funds shares, would necessarily remain in effect. For whatever the specific nature of these claims may be, they represent titles to producer goods. Otherwise, they cannot yield interest. Yet even the most easily convertible production factor must be less saleable than the most saleable one of its final products. And hence, even the most liquid security can never perform the same service of preparing its owner for future contingencies as can be provided by the most marketable final non-interest-bearing product, or money. All of this could be different only if it were assumed, as Wallace, in accordance with the Chicago School's egalitarian predispositions, tacitly does, that all goods are equally marketable. Then, by definition, there is no difference between the salability of cash and securities. However, then all goods must be assumed to be identical to each other. And if this were the case, neither division of labor nor markets would even exist. From commodity money to fiat money. The Devolution of Money. All right, we are going to stop there for today, and we will come back to this piece tomorrow and probably for the remainder of this week and continue discussing these ideas. I hope you guys are going to enjoy this as much as I do. I know the language is a little bit hard to follow sometimes, so I'm going to try to, particularly where I think it was really confusing, I'm going to try to butt in and give a little bit of further explanation and expand on it a little bit. But for now, I want to hit a couple of points in the reading that we have hit so far. So first is just about how a basket of goods can, by definition, not be a better money than the most saleable goods. So in a market of competing goods, there will never be two goods with the exact same, like, long-term saleability. Like, maybe temporarily, like at some one moment or another, maybe they end up matching in some way, but invariably, these things are constantly shifting, and value propositions are constantly shifting in the market against one good versus another. And no matter what, in a market with competing goods, a basket of varied goods by necessity is less saleable than whatever single good among the group has the highest saleability. Therefore, it is a crappier money than whatever that one good is. So that a single best option exists at all, which is impossible not to happen in a market of competition, the basket of goods is simply watering down the optimal solution. So the whole basket of goods idea, making a money, is pointless. And it also immediately leads to the question of, okay, who is storing this basket of goods? How do we know it's backed by this quote-unquote basket of goods? If we are not trading that good in and of itself, which he hits on this, but he doesn't actually expand on this. It's kind of an assumed point, talking about how money is a hedge against uncertainty. Because it's the most saleable good, it is the one that in any condition where you have to trust or there is a risk in, like, holding a security, like we just went over, cash, a bearer instrument, is exactly that hedge. It's insurance against uncertainty, and uncertainty is an omnipresent reality. There is no world. There is no solution to uncertainty. It is the nature of the universe. So that's exactly what we mean, or what he means when he's talking about the fact that there is always a market for the most saleable good, because uncertainty is something that will never be gotten rid of. And then there's another thing that he talks about that we actually hit in this beginning section, and he covers some stuff very relevant to it later on as well, but that competition is invariably going to lead to one money because simply because of the network effect. And this is a huge straw man that is thrown against Bitcoin maximalists, that they're against currency competition. And I follow Bitcoin. I am a Bitcoin quote-unquote maximalist, and I follow pretty much any major Bitcoin maximalist out there. And I'm sure there is some idiot who has suggested that all cryptocurrency should be outlawed except for Bitcoin, but I have never heard this from any respectable Bitcoin maximalist out there, anybody that I consider worth following. This is a ridiculous straw man that is a... it's a much easier to refute version of what is actually being suggested. The actual perspective that that typical maximalist that I put forward myself is that the result of currency competition is absolutely 100% necessary to finding the best money. But currency competition is going to lead to one money. That's where the maximalist position comes from, is that the saleability of one good is always going to outweigh its competitors at some point, and therefore it will become, by its nature is more saleable, it will become more broadly adopted as money. It compounds on itself. So whatever tiny gap there may be is going to inevitably grow from that until there is a single money good because there is inevitably a single monetary market, which is the whole global market of it is the entire globe. So as long as there are no virtual or imposed restrictions between markets, like borders and, you know, government implemented jurisdictions and that kind of thing, as long as those can be the cost of bridging those or crossing those borders is less than the marginal utility of one money versus another, it will always tend towards one money. And the whole idea of Bitcoin is that it is a global market without those jurisdictions. Cryptocurrency is specifically solving that as a major problem, that it removes jurisdictions. It removes those fake boundaries or the walls that are put up by fiat currency. And therefore, as it is a global market, a global marketable good, it will inevitably lead toward one money. All right, and then the another example that he gave that I wanted to explain about the marginal utility, that whole section was kind of wordy, but to prove that money is in fact a good with marginal utility and therefore not a strict measure of value is because money, just like all other goods, follows the law of marginal utility, just perfectly. For instance, if you have $0, if you have no money whatsoever, $1 is extremely valuable to you, as it means the easy acquisition of the most basic consumption goods, which are critical to your survival. Yet, if you have $1 million, another $1 on top of it is basically irrelevant to you. You're not watching that single-digit number like your life depends on it, because it doesn't. The marginal utility of that $1 is vastly different when you have a million than when you have none of them. So this in itself makes money not a strict measure of value, despite it being used as a pricing mechanism. Otherwise, every unit change, even at $1 million price tag, $1,000,001 price tag, would be weighed as an identical difference to a $1 adjustment at a $1 price tag. So the difference between a $1 and $2 a bit of food or something. And clearly that is not the case. So those are a couple things I wanted to clear up, but we will continue discussing this in detail as we move forward, and we will hit this whole piece. I think we're about a fourth of the way through it right now, it looks like. Hard to say exactly. Hopefully we can hit this in four pieces, and maybe I can do a guy's take or something on Friday, because I got a couple of those that I'm still working out details for, but I want to have those discussions soon. And we will be leading into another piece that I haven't actually finished reading it yet, and I think it just dropped like yesterday or the day before. It's by Nick Carter. So if you want to get a head start on that one, this one is really good so far. I'm about a third way through it, but it is titled How to Scale Bitcoin Without Changing a Thing. But I think a lot of the lessons that we're going to cover in this work will actually apply really well to the discussion of Nick Carter's piece. I'm excited to be getting into that very soon. Don't forget to stick with me. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can check out this. I believe I got this, How Fiat Money is Possible, off of Mises.org. Undoubtedly, I'm sure it is up on Mises.org, but the link was actually from Stefan Lavera, who linked the previous Hans Hermann Hoppe piece that we read on the show. So don't forget to give a shout out to Stefan Lavera and thank him for recommending this piece, because this is going to be fun to go through, I think. And So with that, don't forget to check out Mises.org as well, where you can find so much discussion and exploration of these types of topics. And subscribe to the show on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast app is. You can find me on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy, and you can check out CryptoEconomy.life for the entire collection of all of these amazing works and discussion that we have had on this show. We are at like 260-some-odd episodes now, so there is a treasure trove of stuff covering all manner of topics around Bitcoin and the crypto economy over at CryptoEconomy.life. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I will catch you all back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.